It's Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
Scott Martin was a rising star in Wisconsin's soccer community, first as a player, then as a college coach. But he was struck by a rare flesh-eating infection that put him in a coma. He spent weeks fighting for his life. Ultimately, doctors had to amputate his hands and parts of both feet to save him. In the months and years that followed, Martin had to rebuild his body, his mind, and his identity as a coach and athlete. And he had to adapt to living with a disability, from facing discrimination to learning to use special electrically controlled hands. He chronicles his story in his new book, Play From Your Heart, A Journey Through Loss, Resilience, and the Beautiful Game. Martin lives in Stevens Point, where he continues to coach soccer. His memoir is out now. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob. Very good to be here.
Well, I want to take your soccer career up to the point where the action in your book starts. Tell us a little bit about your background in soccer that led you to being a coach at UW-Eau Claire.
I had gone up the traditional ranks of first getting into education, and I was teaching social studies and history at West Bend. Had earned some accolades throughout my career coaching at the high school level. Marilyn Scrivseth, who was the athletic director at the UW-Eau Claire at the time, got a hold of me. We had a great meeting and asked me to come on board and start the program. So that was really an interesting time to be able to take something from nothing and build it. So our first year, we ended up being nationally ranked, and everything was going on good from there until we got to a little bit of a fork in the road.
Yeah. And again, before that fork in the road, you had also played at UW Oshkosh. And this is before, right, soccer was the thing that kids did. You were on an earlier cutting edge for U.S. soccer in a lot of ways.
Yeah, actually, when I was 16, I was playing for the men's team, and we would be playing against larger clubs in the Midwest at that time. So there's a lot of firsthand learning by getting your butt kicked. So actually, at that time, Rob, a lot of it was educating the public, educating the kids that were growing up. A lot of people, one of my favorite things was trying to explain the offside rule to parents at the time in the mid-70s. So that was a difficult thing, but we knew what we had to do to make this game move forward in the United States.
You mentioned that fork in the road. That really changed a lot of, I think, your vision for your future. Talk us through what happened.
That summer after my first year at UW-Eau Claire, like I said, we were nationally ranked. I was heading over to Europe with a group of college players playing three top tournaments over there. I always had opportunities to go in as a guest player. The year before that, I played against the Dutch Olympic team because I knew the coach. So everything was looking great. Nike got a hold of me and said, we've heard some good things. Hey, why don't you come on down and speak at our Midwest camp? 100 of the top high school players in the country. Yeah, you bet. You know, we're going to be their national players, coaches from across the country. And when I got there, I was feeling okay. But after the first day, we got into a coaches exhibition match. And I actually, Rob, I've never done this before. I had to pull myself out because of fatigue. I had no idea what was going on. But I spent that night either throwing up profusely or sweating like crazy and shivering like crazy in my dorm room, realizing something was wrong. Didn't know where any doctors were outside of Chicago, but my mom was in Janesville, an hour and a half away. So we all know if doctor's not available, you go to mom. She, of course, in her female wisdom, said something's wrong, get your butt over to the emergency room right away. And that's where things started tumbling in the wrong direction and going back to speaking about that fork in the road.
And ultimately, you end up in a coma. What you wake up and you do not know what has been happening for, what, weeks, a month, I think, at this point.
A month.
Yeah.
Yeah, a month. I woke up for a doctor. I think he was dancing around the issue and he was soft about it, but I couldn't move because I had lost 40 pounds of muscle through atrophy, being in a coma for a month. That sort of thing happens. And I couldn't speak because I was intubated. There were numerous machines in the room. And then he started going into the spiel about what happened. He said, okay, you had contracted group A strep with necrotizing fasciitis. Okay, I kind of get that. But then when he dropped the bomb of saying, the media has been calling it the flesh-eating disease. You know, this was what killed Jim Henson in 1990, creator of the Muppets. Then he mentioned the word amputation. Okay. And that's when I think my brain started shutting down, Rob, to be in all honesty. That's what I did. I skipped past denial, or excuse me, I didn't skip past denial. I held on to denial strong and hard for years to come. I didn't want to face what was going on. All of a sudden, going from a white guy in athletics being successful to all of a sudden now being labeled as disabled. And I started labeling myself as disabled as well.
You find out you've lost your hands. You're never going to be able to walk again like you did. You went through a long process of rehabilitation. In some ways, one blessing, one benefit of your athletic career, and your doctors and rehab people said to us, you had a mindset that lets you get through that rehab process. Tell us a little bit about that.
I had the work set to be able to go into it, but yet I had no clue what was going on. There were 4 months of rehabilitation in a hospital setting that I still had yet to go through. And then it was, now what? And now what? No clue of what was going to happen. Prosthetists that I worked with, you know, on creating items for disabled people, people with amputations, had never worked with a person that was bilateral hand amputee, let alone bilateral foot, partial foot amputee. So I became a quad amputee. How am I going to deal with that? How am I going to deal with that in our society that doesn't fare well with the disabled community as it is?
And this, I think for a lot of people, is a version of a nightmare. Take the thing you love the most in the world, in your case, soccer, and take away your perception of your ability to do it. You do come back and coach soccer, and we'll get into that. But in that moment, and in those weeks, knowing that, hey, you were never going to be able to go out on a soccer field and play like you had before, how did your mind work with that?
I didn't want to face it, but yet I did. Because to me, the first thing that crossed my mind after hearing about the amputations was, I'm done playing. I was still playing at a higher level. We had just won an indoor championship. I was playing out of Minneapolis. And that was really hard. The way I try to describe it to people is this. Think of a concert pianist. Not saying I was an amazing player or anything, but to me, concert piano. And all of a sudden, somebody takes it away. There it goes. You know, my heart, my art was gone now. That's what I found. Very difficult.
We're talking to Scott Martin of Stevens Point. He's the author of the new memoir, Play From Your Heart, A Journey Through Loss, Resilience, and the Beautiful Game. It follows his experience as a soccer player and coach, the illness that led to the loss of both of his hands and parts of both feet, and what came next. Scott, you did go back to soccer, to coaching at various levels. You've remained attached to the game since then. What led you to say, hey, I'm not giving up, at least on this coaching part of soccer?
Oh, after the hospital, I mean, like I said, Rob, that I coached for 4 more years, but I ended up at the college level. I ended up running into the brick wall depression, which is no surprise. And in the book, that's the first thing I had to do when I was writing, be totally open and honest so people could get inside of my head, inside of my emotions on this. So I did, but I also realized that my coaching was becoming less than, my recruiting was becoming less than. We ended up falling out of the national rankings. I ended up resigning because that's what I should have done for the program. And from there, I mean, I ended up getting into a point where I decided to break myself down in order to build myself back up. I had to go through something extremely difficult in order to, I guess, rediscover myself. So that's a different fork in the road, again, that I ended up taking myself down this time. I was under control this time, and that's what I was going to do.
You mentioned depression being a wall. Another wall came from outside of you, people's perceptions of you as somebody who wanted to coach this active game with a disability. I think you overheard somebody after a job interview saying something like, why'd you bring a guy with no hands in to coach, you know, to audition as a soccer coach? The things you saw from potential employers, from players and others, mm-hmm. How did that affect you?
Mm-hmm. I lost some of my belief in society because I had never, you know, again, I went from a white guy coaching the athletics that was successful to now being labeled as disabled. And I found out what that's been like. And it's interesting, Rob, that I've never been, in my mind, on how I view someone as being discriminatory against me or not. I've never found discrimination from a female. It's always come from males. And I'm not a psychologist to get into studying that, but it is intriguing. I think it has a lot to do with male mortality and the fear that what happened to me could happen to them. And I don't think males are capable or are less capable than females of being able to cope with something like that. See, because going back, when I first found out I lost my hands and such, I distanced myself. I didn't want to deal with it. So I get it.
One interesting tell that you come back to repeatedly in the book is, what do people do when they go to shake your hand and they see their your hands aren't what they were expecting to see?
Mm-hmm. It's most interesting, Rob, when someone shakes my hand, because it's an automatic thing to not look at the hand. You just meet hands. And if they happen to notice when they're shaking my hand, oftentimes, and again, it's always been males, pull back, not knowing, and I get it. You know, all of a sudden you're it's not a physical hand. It's not skin. It's rubber, the glove that I wear over these. And I've come across that sometimes where they've even, I sense a reaction that they have something over me, that they think less of me and therefore my team. But that ends up being a positive for me because I use that in my preparation and thoughts as we go into that match. Because teams, players reflect how their coaches are. And therefore, they just gave me some free information. I'm going to use that information. And most of the time, we ended up beating teams like that. It is interesting.
One of my favorite portions of the book, Scott, is you're coaching for a club team. And the staff there looks at you and assigns you the C team, right? Well, these are the kids. We're glad we're making money from their parents. They're not going to go anywhere. How did you rise to that challenge?
Oh, well, there was a 20-year gap between me leaving coaching at the college level. I had an opportunity to become the head coach at Gonzaga. And I ended up going, first of all, in a very different direction. I ended up becoming a parent of five kids, two from Romania, three from Ethiopia. I came back when my youngest was old enough to be able to handle it. And that's what I ran into, another sense of position of discrimination. I don't know if they looked at my resume, they had to. But yet, no, you're not going to coach A team, not the B team. Here's, you know, 12-year-olds, you get the C team. Yeah, like you said, Rob, bring in those checks. But that, to me, spurred me because it's strange how life can be. At this exact same time, I was coming around and returning to who I was. So therefore, working with these kids, they were just lacking confidence. They could play. They were just lacking confidence. So we ended up going on the same journey together. And that's what the second half of the book is all about. And I think that's what a lot of people are glomming onto and calling this a positive story in negative times. It's working with those 12-year-olds and how we both, or all of us, went down that same path for saying to heck with you to the people that thought that they couldn't do something and thought that I couldn't do something.
I'm going to detour a little as a longtime soccer parent watching from the sidelines. I love the way you approach coaching with your players. You talk about giving them the skills and the tools they need to make decisions on the field and know the flow of the game and go where they be. Whereas I've seen coaching that's you be in the spot that fits my scheme, and if you don't, you're in trouble. Why do you? And that seems, your way seems a more fun and a better way to develop people. Tell us a little bit about that philosophy.
I don't know why people have gotten, you know, I grew up with football, basketball, baseball as well, and that's very structured. But the coach, Klaus Kroner, who took me under his wing again when I was 16, I learned a lot about the freedom of the game. And I studied Johan Cruyff and what the Dutch were doing and Pep Guardiola with what he did with Barcelona and then with Manchester City. It's the game itself, Rob, is so free-flowing. For example, I bring a boombox. We play music at our training sessions. Not for the players, but for me to try to get them into that flow of the music, because we play jazz, blues, rock, you know, reggae, Motown, even some disco. So there's something free-flowing about it. And I've always had a mantra that has been, my mission is not to teach you, but to put you in a position to learn. It's totally different. But once they get it, and once they accept freedom, it's rock solid. And they become better players, and therefore they become a better team. Just because of something so simple, that's the way I look at it. It's simple. This game is free-flowing. Why not let the players free flow, you know, flow freely? As As long as they have the basic concepts, then they take it where they want to.
And Scott, as we wrap up, what are you hoping people take away from this memoir now that it's out in the world?
I hope they find it thought-provoking. I hope it gets people to talk about the disability community. Heck, we're coming out during the World Cup. Just to get stir some conversation. We could all use a positive story. And if it's picked up that way, I'm totally happy with that.
Scott, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Scott Martin, award-winning soccer coach, educator, and advocate for the disability community. We've been talking about his new memoir. It's called Play From Your Heart, A Journey Through Loss, Resilience, and the Beautiful Game.
Coming up, meet 9-year-old Levi, who just biked with his family from New York City to Madison, 1,400 miles in about 6 weeks.
Every bike trip, I just feel amazed that I've done this much miles. And this bike trip, I was just wowed what I could do and what I could perform.
That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
Bike packing is a blend of mountain biking and backpacking. Fans of the sport strap camping gear to their backs and bike miles through the wilderness, sometimes for weeks.
One young Wisconsinite recently completed a nearly 6-week bike packing journey from Central Park in New York City to his hometown of Madison. Safe to say, 9-year-old Levi Moss is an avid biker.
Levi's dad, Joe Linus, traveled weeks alongside Levi and other family members. And Evan Moss is Levi's mom, another avid bikepacker who rotated in on this multi-state adventure with Levi. Evan, Joe, and Levi, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Levi, you're 9. Why did you want to go on this very long bikepacking expedition?
Well, every year I've done it with my cousins, my parents, and it's really fun. And this year I just wanted to go big, so.
Yeah. Go big you did. 1,400 miles, is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. Why did you start in Central Park?
I didn't really do the planning. My parents and my grandpa did. But I think New York, it was a good distance. New York is fun to be in, so we just started there.
Okay, so good distance. It's a long way. Joe, I understand that parents got in on this, an uncle, grandpa, multiple cousins traveled parts of the way with Levi. Has your family been changed by this experience?
Yeah, most definitely. We're all adventurous bikers, as Levi mentioned, but to be able to coordinate a 6-week journey with extended family, and to see Levi complete it and see his 7-year-old sister participate along the way. Yeah, I think it's an adventure we won't forget, and we have memories to draw on for the rest of our life.
What did you learn from it, Joe?
One of the main themes for me is, first of all, just how fun it is to explore the country with family and see your kiddos set a goal, and to be able to accomplish it together is really, really magical. So I just think if we can instill adventure and fun in our kids like this, that's a great thing I hope to do as a parent.
Levi, how does it feel now that you've completed this?
Well, every bike trip, I just feel amazed that I've done this much miles, and this bike trip, I was just wowed at what I could do and what I could perform.
Okay, so you're on a bike all day long on this journey. What did you think about as you were biking all day? Did you let your mind wander?
Well, yeah. I try to keep myself busy. Sometimes it gets boring just pedaling for 8 hours a day. So I just try to think about my family, think about like just stuff.
Yeah, we played a lot of word games, a lot of chatter.
Yeah,
and some quiet moments too.
Yeah. I understand, Evan, that long distance bicycling runs in the family. What about the activity draws you all to it?
I think the joy of just hopping on a bike and the thrill of kind of just moving forward at a bike's pace, you know, it's not too slow that you get really bored, and it's not too fast that you're zooming by everything. It's just kind of a perfect pace. I don't know if I can speak for everyone in my family, but I think there is this like sense of childhood, like a joy from childhood about just like hopping on your bike that has stayed with us.
When did you first introduce Levi to biking?
Well, I think he was almost four and he biked around Lake Monona.
Yeah.
That was our first. It was like a 4-hour, 3 ice cream stop, 12-mile ride around Lake Monona. And that was the first summer. And then the next summer he biked from Milwaukee to Madison.
Yeah. Yeah. He was pedaling a Strider bike at 2.5. Yeah.
Wow. Levi, do you remember this?
Not really when I was like 3 and younger, but I do remember just the joy of pedaling and going down hills.
Yeah, certainly the stopping for ice cream and the going down hills. Those are good times. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, Levi, as you were biking from New York City to Wisconsin, was there a favorite spot that you biked through that you remember?
I guess my favorite part was in Pennsylvania. There, we biked through a lot of Amish country, and it was just I was so amazed to see how the Amish like lived and grew up.
Did you see some horses?
Yeah, we saw horses pulling buggies, like no technology, different clothes.
Mm-hmm. What happened when you felt really tired along the way? What did you do when you felt tired, Levi?
I mean, I try not to get tired because it'll just like control me and I won't be able to keep going. So I try to keep my mind off of it. I take a break if I need to, but you just try to like go as much as you can.
Mm-hmm. Evan, as a mom, I would feel a little scared that something could happen to my child out on the open road. Did you grapple at all with those fears?
Yeah. I mean, there were moments when I was with them that there were a few crazy drivers. And some busy roads. I think I had a lot of trust that the adults that were with Levi had safety as a top priority. My dad was with him, my brother, so his uncle was with him, my husband here, Joe, was with him. So there was just a lot of trust that we all, you know, would do everything we can to be safe and have fun. I think the hardest part was the logistics, not actually the safety aspect.
The logistics and planning it out, where to stay overnight. What was that planning like, Joe?
I think it was harder to imagine than to execute. When we started planning the various weeks of each of the adults, there's so much unknown about how is the drop-off going to go? Are the places to stay going to work out as you want it to? So you just, like Evan said, just trusting the adults in the process, knowing that safety was a top priority, all of the logistics of where to sleep and when someone drives out, it kind of took care of itself. But the biggest logistic was week one, getting everybody out to New York City. And the first week we had 9 bikers on that first week. So getting everybody down the Eastern Seaboard was probably the most logistically challenging I felt.
Wow, 9 bikers. Yeah, moving all along. Levi, what would you tell other kids who don't think they have the stamina to bike 1,400 miles like you did? What would you tell another kid?
Well, I didn't just do this. Like, I was building up to it. My first, like, real bike ride was only, like, 0.1 miles. So you kind of just have to build up to the point where I'm at, and then just tell them that, are you ready for adventure? And if they say yes or no, then go for it.
Just go for it. Okay, can you tell me where your next big biking trip is? Have you started planning?
Well,
Before this one got planned, we were thinking of going across America, but I think it was just too hard for us to plan, and we weren't feeling up for that big adventure. And, you know, maybe this following year we might accomplish that.
Wow. Well, Levi, Evan, and Joe, you are an inspiration. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. This has been fun.
Yeah, thank you so much.
We've been talking about Levi and his family going on a bikepacking journey from New York City to Wisconsin over nearly 3 weeks. Now, Wisconsin has over 1,700 miles of beautiful state trails for bikers to enjoy, from the classic Elroy Sparta to the scenic Mountain Bay. Missy Van Landit is the Recreation Partnerships Section Chief for the Department of Natural Resources. Missy, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What do you think of 9-year-old Levi and his family's cross-country bikepacking journey to Wisconsin?
You know, I am just in awe of Levi. What an experience at 9 years old. It's so inspiring. And honestly, for me, working with trails and being outside, so rewarding to hear his story and how much he loved it.
And families like Levi's might want to start maybe at a smaller scale with a bikepacking trip through Wisconsin, you know, on our state scenic trails. What would you suggest for a longer ride or maybe even a multi-day ride for a family?
Yeah, absolutely. So in Wisconsin, we actually have our state trail network plan. So ultimately, a long-term goal is actually to connect state trails with municipal trails, county trails from Superior all the way down through the south and back up to Green Bay. So there's a lot of different options, you know, depending on what part of the state you're in. And here in the southern part of the state, you can utilize the Hank Aaron State Trail, then to the Glacial Drumlin State Trail, on up through the, you know, Great Sauk State Trail to the 400 to the Elroy Sparta. And that could be a multi-day camping trip as well, because a lot of our state trails, many folks don't realize, actually have campsites associated with them.
What would you suggest for a longer distance route that's not really hilly, that is nice and flat?
You know, a lot of our linear trails were rail trails, and so many of them are pretty flat and linear as it is. And one of the really cool trails that I love, I think that's a bit of a hidden gem, is actually the Mountain Bay State Trail, and it's named for the mountain in the bay. It goes from Rib Mountain through Marathon and Shawano counties over to Brown County, and it's just over 80 miles long, and it's a pretty short or a pretty flat stretch through there. But at 83 miles, you can definitely get a couple of days out of that, but it's still pretty flat.
And Wisconsin isn't home to mountains, but we do have some mountain biking trails. What does our state offer for mountain bikers?
You know, mountain biking, I feel like, is the front runner for up and coming outdoor recreation right now. So we're actually in the process. We've got mountain bike trails at so many different properties, and they're actually continuing to construct new trails at multiple properties. Just a week or so ago, we opened 11 miles of mountain bike trail at Peninsula State Park. There's going to be mountain bike trails at Rib Mountain State Park that'll be under construction later this year and through 2027 and 28. There's new miles going in at New Glarus Woods State Park, the northern and southern unit of the Kettle Moraine, Blue Mound State Park, and in the last couple of years at Willow River and Kinnikinick State Parks in the west central part of the state have just opened new mountain bike trails. So, and we're actually opening very soon here additional mountain bike trails up at the Brule River State Forest. So there are a lot of miles of trail in Wisconsin and in every corner of the state as well.
It sounds like you're answering a demand, that you felt demand for these types of trails.
Absolutely. You know, the great thing too is there are so many incredible mountain bike groups. There's clubs and organizations that partner with us at the state to implement, and, you know, they fundraise for these trails, they help build these trails and maintain them. You know, and we work with youth mountain bike groups and racing groups as well on volunteer days and hosting events. So it really is a rising, you know, recreation opportunity. And there's a ton of kids that are participating in it. And again, they're participating in the stewardship aspect of it too, by building and maintaining and protecting those trails.
You've described state trails as both a doorway and a window into enjoying the Wisconsin outdoors. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, so we always talk about the doorway to recreation as being something that is pretty low barrier as far as getting into the outdoors. And so while if you're 16 or older and you're biking on our trails, you do need a trail pass, but our linear trails and so many trails across the state are great for hiking, and you really just need a decent pair of shoes. And so it's a great way if you've never participated in outdoor recreation or you want to get outside a little bit more. It's kind of the doorway to ease in. And the window, you know, I've biked a lot of trails across the state, and Wisconsin has such a diverse landscape. You know, whether you're on the Niagara Escarpment in the eastern part of the state, or you're in, you know, the oak savannas of the central part, or the driftless area in the southwest, you get urban areas and rural farm fields and small communities. So it's really the window to explore all the landscapes and communities that Wisconsin has to offer.
And maybe it makes us realize just the diversity of landscapes, the diversity of views that you can see on this bike ride.
You know, absolutely. You know, I have so many favorite trails across the state, and it's largely because of the experiences that you can have on those trails. And I know Levi was talking about ice cream. That's one of my favorite things to do. You know, our state trails can cross many counties and go through hundreds of communities, so many of which might be a corner store or a gas station, but you can always grab ice cream while you're out on the trail.
Missy, thank you so much. Good to talk with you.
You too. Thanks for having me.
That is Missy Van Landit, the Recreation Partnerships Section Chief for the Department of Natural Resources. We've been talking about getting out and enjoying many of the Wisconsin State Bike Trails. And earlier, we heard from 9-year-old Levi Moss and his parents, Evan Moss and Joe Lanis, about Levi's nearly 6-week bikepacking adventure, cycling from New York City Central Park to their home in Madison. Coming up, adopting a child can feel like a roller coaster. A Wisconsin parent shares his adoption stories in a new memoir.
We felt so very blessed to wind up with our sons and to wind up with relationships with people beyond them due to adoption.
That's next on WPR News.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to Wisconsin Weekend.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Every summer, people flock to Wisconsin's North Woods to relax, enjoy the beautiful scenery, and hopefully spot some interesting wildlife.
Writer Nancy Jorgensen reflects on a summer family trip and the search for one of the state's most iconic wild birds.
What spends every summer at a Wisconsin lake hasn't changed in a million years and is black and white and loved all over. I arrived in June at my daughter Elizabeth's Tomahawk Lake House to search for loons, for that drawn-out wail that haunts the half-light just before sunset, for that black-and-white checkered body paddling the surface before it dives below to dine. But before I could do that, Elizabeth scheduled a hike. On a nippy Minocqua morning, we set off on the Bearskin Trail. As my canvas shoes crunched over crushed gravel, I set an app to record bird calls. Elizabeth and her partner, Josh, sprang into a 3-kilometer run, but my husband, Joel, my sister-in-law, and I moseyed. More than exercise, I was interested in trees, creeks, bogs, and the pond where turtles sunbathe. I would search for loons later at the lake. As my app recorded a yellow-throat sparrow and goldfinch, I spotted a bird in flight. A black head, bill like a dagger, flat white body, and awkward webbed feet sliced through the sky. My sister-in-law lifted her binoculars. Is that a loon? Before I could answer, the loon introduced herself with a flight tremolo. Short, repetitive notes wavering quickly up and down. So fixed on the idea of loons at the lake, I never expected to spy one in the sky. It winged away before I could raise a camera, but my app confirmed its call. After the hike, back at Elizabeth's house, she dished out popcorn and Chex Mix and taught us a new card game. A writer and educator with two Wisconsin homes and a daily fitness routine, she leads a busy life. But she prioritizes family, and these weeks in Minocqua have become tradition. As she dealt a hand, I cracked the window, trading warmth for the possibility of a whale. 30 minutes later, I lost the card game, but scored a loon's slow, prolonged cry. It felt like a gift, unpredictable and perfect. "You heard one," Elizabeth said. "Now let's look for loons on the water." So, bundled in quilts, we puttered around Tomahawk Lake on her tritune. Just minutes into our ride, Joel pointed. "Loons," he whispered, and Josh slowed the boat, then stopped. We drifted, silent. Two black heads played hide-and-seek with us, bobbing and dipping, then resurfacing unexpectedly elsewhere. I didn't know that loons lay eggs in mid-May, that the chicks leave the nest within 24 hours, ready to swim. I didn't know that on June 11th, I should be alert for more than adult loons. On the next day's tritune ride, Joel pointed again, and I spotted a tiny speck floating between two checkered birds. 42 years ago, Joel and I also introduced a baby to the world. She took to it like that loonlet, curious, adventurous, and independent. That night, we watched a documentary on Wisconsin loons and discovered that, like us, they choose a summer location and return each year to the place of their hearts. After 5 days, more knowledgeable and more content, we packed for home, already planning our next visit to Tomahawk Lake. I came to the lake to hear loons and found a reminder that love roots itself in family and place. The lake, the loons, the games at a kitchen table, these are the things to be treasured. Worthy of attention and care, so they will endure.
Nancy Jorgensen is a writer and musician from Waukesha. This piece was produced by Sarah Hopeful. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. This is WPR News.
Adopting a child can be like a roller coaster ride. And like roller coasters, no two adoption experiences are exactly the same.
That's according to the Wisconsin author of a new memoir sharing his experiences as an adoptive parent.
Rick Parks of West Bend has lived in Wisconsin since 1999. He shares his adoption stories in his new book, Sons of Other Fathers, a memoir of adoption, identity, and the relationships that define family. Rick, thanks for joining us.
It's a great pleasure to be here with you today.
You describe the adoption experience as a roller coaster, and you write that every adoption roller coaster is unique. What led you to share your story and write this memoir of your own roller coasters?
Well, our experience with adoption at the end was very, very fortunate. And there are many situations out there with people that are involved with adoption where the struggles are immense, and sometimes the outcomes can be less than what many people would have hoped. And from our perspective, we felt so very blessed to wind up with our sons and to wind up with relationships with people beyond them due to adoption, that I just felt strongly it was a story that I wanted to tell.
And as you write, you and your wife wanted to have kids, wasn't happening. What put that idea of adoption in your mind?
Well, we'd been married at the time we even began to talk about this 12 years, which is perhaps beyond the time span most people would start thinking about it. But, you know, it occurred that, at that point, we had not even looked into the issues that might be present with fertility. But it seemed like something we should get the wheels rolling. And if you had a natural child later on, you know, all the better, you know, the more the merrier.
Your first adoption was a closed process. For people who haven't been through adoption, what does that mean?
Well, closed adoption is really less common these days than it was 30 some years ago when we did that. But in a closed adoption, none of the parties really know who the other one is. So birth parents have no knowledge of the adoptive parents. The adoptive parents have no knowledge of the birth parents. And literally at different times in the past, these records were sealed completely. So that was kind of the norm for adoptions if you go back 30 years and even prior to that. So, you know, our first adoption was strictly just a situation where people knew people who knew people, and we were able to be connected and got a wonderful son that we have now.
Now, as an adoptive parent myself, the moment when I first laid eyes on our girls will forever etched in my mind. You'd been through a long process talking and then going through legal things and whatnot. Take us to that moment when you first met Matthew.
Well, when Matthew came to be with us, our attorney and his wife, who were friends of ours, we knew these people, pulled up in his silver Eldorado car because he was an attorney and he could afford one of those. And they brought him into our home, and there he was. It was just quite a memorable time for us.
Well, and that's really when the reality hits, right? You've been doing bureaucracy for months and months, and now here's this life in your hands.
Yeah, and for us, we tried to be mentally prepared that something could go wrong. Mm-hmm. We certainly wanted to be our best to be prepared, but on some level, we had that in the back of our mind all along that, well, this might not work out. And to that extent, it became very, very real when our attorney and his wife left, and here we had our baby.
And that's a big part of the adoption process. And you write about this. There are a lot of these periods where you're waiting and you know things could go either way. And we'll talk about that. You've got a couple more adoption experiences. Waiting is just a huge part of adoption, isn't it?
It very much is. And again, you know, there's a lot of emotional capital involved in adoption. And certainly, you know, you want to have your heart open to be ready and to accept it and to be the best parents you can be. But as I said, there's, you know, probably for your benefit, it's always good to just keep it in mind a little bit that this one might not go well. And if that happens, there'll be another one.
And you went into the process a second time. You weren't in Wisconsin yet, if I have this timeline right, but the prospective adoptee had been born in Wisconsin, which required a certain waiting period in a foster home. First of all, what led you to say, hey, we've been very happy with this experience with Matthew. We want to go and adopt again?
Well, you know, for us, you know, we both had other siblings. My wife had two sisters and a brother, and I had an older sister. And we valued the idea that you had a sibling. I mean, we were and remain very close to our siblings, and we just thought that was something we wanted for Matthew. Being older parents, you know, you realistically, you know, if you adopt in your mid-30s, early 40s, your children are going to be out there on their own at some point because you're not going to be around. And to have that sibling that you could say, I grew up with this guy, he's my brother, we really thought that was important.
We're talking to Rick Parks of West Bend about his new book. It's called Sons of Other Fathers, a memoir of adoption, identity, and the relationships that define family. Now, that second try at adoption you mentioned earlier, you're waiting and you're always sure that there's a possibility that might not happen. And in this case, it didn't. What, when you found out that this adoption wasn't going to proceed, what did that do for you and your wife?
Well, at least in our case, already having adopted Matthew and having him in our home certainly made it a little easier. And frankly, it was an incredibly quick process to be selected by this birth mother because this was an open adoption. It was a very quick process to be selected, and she was well along to her delivery time. So the waiting was not extremely long by any means. So I suppose if you were ever going to have a situation where you had a change of heart after the birth of a child, this would be the one you'd want to have. It kind of rolls into all of the blessings that we've had in adoption. Even our change of heart experience was a little less crushing than many might be.
And then you ended up with the third try of bringing Kyle into your lives. And this was, again, an open process. And you have not only had contact with Kyle's birth mom for years, you eventually connected with Matthew's birth dad, even though it was a closed process. Not every adoptive parent wants that contact. Why was that important for you to do at least what you were able to do?
Well, this is one of those cases where a very good thing in one aspect can be a difficult thing in another one. And in our situation, our experience with Kyle's birth parents, and especially his birth mother, was so very, very good that as a young boy, 5 years old, Matthew noticed this, and he didn't have that in his life. And we could tell every time we got together with Kyle's birth parents, he would be a little down for a while. And you could tell it was troubling him. And then finally, one of the early parts of the book, he posed that question, why didn't my birth parents want to know me? And that was just, a gut punch for me and my wife. And it really set us to be open to the idea that maybe this mixing open and closed adoptions is not the ideal way to do this. Maybe we ought to think about, having some process of trying to connect with Matthew's birth parents as well.
And ultimately, you were able to do that. And I love throughout the book, there was, I felt like, never a sense you had of competition, right? Or, oh, they're thinking of those other parents as the real parents and we're not. This idea of embracing this wider family for your kids, can you talk about that a little?
Well, you have to have confidence that, if you're raising a child and they're with you all the days of their life, early on, of course, you've bonded with them as a parent. And, the fact that there's biological parents out there as well, did we have thoughts that might, be something that would come up? Of course. And especially Matthew's birth father is just an outstanding individual, as is Kyle's birth mother. These are great, great people that you could and should admire on a lot of levels. So, there might have been a little of that in the back of your mind, but, for the good of your child, you do what you need to do.
Now, knowing that the adoption roller coaster can take a lot of unexpected twists and turns, and it's going to be different and it will follow different paths than yours did. If a prospective parent says to you, hey, I'm thinking about adoption, you've written a book about it, what advice would you give them as they start in that process?
Well, I would tell them to be prepared for the roller coaster to shift. This might not go entirely as planned. You have to have that in the back of your mind while, as I said earlier, still opening your heart up that we want to be parents to a child. We want to, bring a child in and give them all our love and all our support. But certainly be prepared if things don't go according to plan, and then be committed to we'll get back on the roller coaster and try again.
Rick, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you for having me.
That was Rick Parks from West Bend. His new book is called Sons of Other Fathers, a memoir of adoption, identity, and the relationships that define a family. Well, if you're an adoptive parent like Rick or like me, you probably have a story to share. We'd love to hear about it, your experiences with the adoption process, what good came out of it, the challenges you faced along the way, and the advice you'd have for other people going through the adoption process. Let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Again, that email, wisconsintoday@wpr.org, with your adoption stories. Weekend might be a good time to settle in with a book or dig into that stack on your nightstand, and we're wondering, what are your favorite reads, especially by Wisconsin authors?
Is there a particular genre you like the best, or is there a book you picked up recently that surprised you?
Tell us about your favorite reads. We're always up for book recommendations. We'd love to share what's on your reading list.
And while you're at it, give a shout out to a book group.
send us an email at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can text us or send us a voicemail to talk about great books in your life. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
And thanks for sharing your story about a love of reading.
Wisconsin Weekend is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.